Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For a month now, violence has raged in Kenya over an unresolved presidential election and widespread accusations that the December vote was rigged for incumbent Mwai Kibaki. More than 850 people are dead, countless injured and driven from their homes. The top American diplomat for Africa describes the violence as ethnic cleansing. UN Chief Ban Ki-moon is warning of catastrophe. Until now, Kenya had been in many ways the envy of Africa, a strong economy, a peaceful democracy. Now, Kenya is in flames. This hour On Point, we'll look at the crisis in Kenya. A month ago, it was a stolen election and voting that was at the heart of the news. 2 weeks ago, NPR reporter Gwen Tompkins reported on Kenya's Rift Valley for Morning Edition. Let's just listen back. We'll bring this right up to date in a moment. But here, she describes that area and some of what was then the recent violence.
The worst of Kenya's post-election violence has happened here in the majestic Rift Valley, where creation is at its best. Gentle hills slope into rippling streams. Wild yellow daisies are in bloom. Plump cattle have seemingly endless fields to graze, and even the donkeys look satisfied. But a murderous spirit has taken hold of the valley. Much of Kenya has settled down by now, but here, death threats are still being whispered over cell phones, and the morgues are full. Rosemary Nasimiu had 5 children at home with her the other night when she awoke to the sound of a gunshot.
I told my children, now we are dead.
Arsonists had set fire to her thatched roofed hut and then stood in the doorway so she couldn't escape. When they moved to light another house afire, Nasimiu, who is 53 years old, ran through the flames with the children and hid in the daisies. In all, more than 30 houses burned that night.
They came up to here to check whether we are dead. We were dead in the house. They knocked the door and said, we have killed them.
They knocked on the door and said, we have killed them. That was 2 weeks ago. NPR's Gwen Tompkins in Kenya's Rift Valley. She says there, much of the violence has settled down. In the weeks since, that violence has very much come back. Joining me now from Kisumu in western Kenya on the shore of Lake Victoria is Jonathan Lejard, East Africa correspondent for The Economist magazine. Kisumu has been hit by fierce ethnic cleansing in the last month, with thousands of Kenya's long-dominant Kikuyu tribe driven from the city. Jonathan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Just bring us up to date, if you would, please. 2 weeks ago, our NPR reporter saw things settling down. The news has not looked at all settled in the days since then. What's happening now with violence in Kenya and in Kisumu, where you are today?
Well, I'll give you an idea, Tom. I just came back from my hotel. I set off out of town this morning, and getting back into town, we were stopped by about 40 roadblocks. Massive crowds of youth, people being beaten up, cars being burned, police firing shots. It's a war zone, really. The only thing they need is people to fight, and unfortunately they've driven all of the Kikuyus out of Kisumu and Nyanza province already. So many of the youth that I spoke to are these roadblocks, which are made up of piles of boulders and rocks, burning tires and telegraph poles that he ripped down. They declared very openly that they would slit the throat of any Kikuyu man, woman, or child who passed by. And the anger is just profound and deep. Many of them were carrying placards saying, Kofi Annan, go home. And then equals government, and they were even burning out ambulances, which, as anyone who's been in Africa knows, there are not too many ambulances around. But they burned all these ambulances because they had Government of Kenya license plates, and that was enough for them to feel that they've destroyed these vehicles.
Jonathan, stand by for a moment. We know that Kofi Annan has been in Nairobi this week trying to get the parties to sit down. They began sitting down, I believe, yesterday to talk through a potential resolution, though he's describing that as months or a year away. Ultimately, he opened talks, trying to get talks between supporters of Kibaki and his opposition opponent, Raila Odinga. Let's just listen to him talking after the death of a leading opposition figure earlier this week.
It is absolutely essential and urgent that violence be stopped, and I urge the government to take extraordinary measures to protect the civilian population and promote harmony and understanding. There is only one Kenya. We all have multiple identities, but I hope you see yourselves as Kenyans first. We must stress what unites us and not what divides us.
Kofi Annan speaking this week in Kenya. There is only one Kenya, he says there. But as we've just heard from Jonathan Lejard in Kisumu, on the shores of Lake Victoria, it is not looking very united at the moment. Jonathan in Kenya, please stand by for a moment. I want to bring into our conversation as well, if I may, Kenda Mutongi. She's an associate professor of history, chair of the Africana Studies Department, Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. She grew up in a small village, Maragoli, near Kisumu, where her mother still lives. She's author of Worries of the Heart, Widows, Family, and Community in Kenya. Kenda Mutongi, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
When this violence began after the disputed election a month ago, we heard many Kenyans saying, please do not put this in tribal terms. We are not hostages to tribalism in Kenya. But it looks that way now. Is it, Kenda?
Yes. Well, I think it's changed. I think it started out as people really feeling that the election had been rigged and they had been cheated out of their votes. And then I think that it's transformed kind of into more of a kind of ethnic cleansing, where a lot of the opposition folks felt like the Kikuyus had been part of this. And I think increasingly now, to me, it's looking like it's a class thing. By that I mean, it looks like it's a majority of really poor people who really feel that hopeless, that are fighting and burning everything. So I see kind of a transformation over the last month.
Here's a transition this week from a radio transmission from the Nairobi shanty town, speaking of class issues, calling for peace from the shanty town of Kibera.
On radio frequency 99.9, this is Pamoja FM.
You are being a refugee in your own country. Ni vibaya sana sana sana.
That's why we are preaching peace. We want peace.
We are preaching peace. We want peace. Jonathan Lejard in Kisumu, Kenya. What you described there today looks nothing like peace. UN Chief Ban Ki-moon is warning of catastrophic violence if some solution isn't found here. Does it appear to you that there's still room for this to become much more widespread, much worse?
I wouldn't like to compare it to Rwanda, but I do think the potential for violence is there, and I think I'm very depressed. Anyone who travels around Kenya right now can see a country which is falling apart. It's quite clear that in any practical sense, Western Kenya is ungovernable by Mwai Kibaki. He simply cannot govern this part of the country. And as we know, 10% of the people in Nyanza province have AIDS. Malaria rates are endemic. Simply getting children to school so they have a competitive chance in the Kenyan economy. The schools in Western Kenya haven't opened yet. Mm-hmm. All these are really pressing issues. But the one issue I would emphasize very much is unemployment and underemployment. It's very important to see that wherever you are, it's young, unemployed or underemployed men who are venting their hostility and their, as your other guest said, your sense of hopelessness. Kenyan economy this year has to produce 570,000 jobs just to be where it was in 2007. That is not going to happen. And the populist undercurrent will just keep rising, and the violence will keep rising, and I really am very, very worried for the state of the country.
Kenda Mutongi, was the rest of the world simply living with illusions about Kenya? I mean, it had been sort of, it had settled into this reputation as the great hope, at least from the outside. Was that just a facade even before this violence broke out?
Yes and no. I think that the economy was growing and a good number of people were doing fairly well. But at the same time, I think that there were a lot of poor people who have been ignored by the government, by the Kenyan leaders. And so while on the surface it looked like, the country looked prosperous, especially if you go to some sections of Nairobi, there are a lot of poor people in the slums, and so I think yes and no, but in general I think it's been a fairly peaceful country.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about crisis in Kenya, East Africa's great hope, melting down in the last month in tribal violence after a disputed election, and what that means for the country, for the region, for U.S. hopes in East Africa, for East Africans' hopes for their own region. We've been joined by Kenda Mutongi. She's chair of the Africana Studies Department at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts, and from Kenya, from the city of Kisumu, Kenya, on the shores of Lake Victoria, where there has been a lot of what the lead American diplomat for Africa, Jendai Frazier, is now calling ethnic cleansing in recent days. The East Africa correspondent for The Economist magazine, Jonathan Lejard, is with us. Here's Kofi Annan speaking from a slum in Nakuru, sitting in the heart of Kenya's Rift Valley, about the aftermath of recent attacks.
We saw people pushed from their homes, from their farms, grandmothers, children, families uprooted, and I think it is important that all Kenyans respond with sympathy and understanding and not try to revenge.
There's a plea from former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan trying to weave together some kind of settlement in Kenya. It's not working yet. On Monday, opposition leader, he who was challenging the incumbent for the presidency, who claims he won it and now wants it, responded to the killing of Mugabe Ware, another opposition leader.
There is, of course, a lot of rumors that are flowing around. We do hope and expect that investigations are going to be carried out by the law enforcement agencies. But as you can see, this country is drifting into a state of anarchy.
Raila Odinga, the man who would be president, the opposition leader, who says he was robbed. International observers, many say that the election did not look right, that it may indeed have been rigged. Let's get a call from Pamela in Litchfield, Connecticut. Pamela, you're on the air.
Hello. I would like to say it's lovely to hear Kenda Kindungi talking. Jumbo, Mama.
Jumbo.
I lived in Kenya for 13 years. I still maintain a home there. I go back to Nairobi every year for 2 months. I am horrified by two men who are at each other's throats trying to destroy a country. The Kikuyu and the Luo have always been the strongest tribes in Kenya.
And there you're speaking of the tribe of this, the incumbent president, Mwai Kibaki Kikuyu, and Luo of Raila Odinga, the challenger.
Exactly. And Kenyatta was excellent in keeping any form of quote-unquote tribalism in check. When we had President Moi, things changed a tad. Hello?
Yes, we're here.
But what bothers me so extremely, because I so love the country, speak the language, and still have an enormous connection with it.
Why do you think this is happening, Pamela?
I think it's because two men are being very greedy. There's no question that there have always been fingers in the pot for all bits and pieces of aid that have been given to the country. And Odinga's father was another story. But what it really bothers me, and I really do think it has to do with literally getting the fingers in the pot, I see men on television wearing $10,000 suits that they're having made in England and Italy. And they're causing such chaos. Will they be able to put the lid back on Pandora's box?
Pamela, let us pick it up. And Kenda Mutungi, let me turn to you. Raila Odinga, the challenger, a very successful businessman, he specifically made tribal complaints part of his campaign for the presidency, said that the Kikuyu tribe, which had been dominant in much of Kenyan politics and economics since independence, had been on top too long. It was time for others to have their share at the table. Does that leave this on his head, Kenda Mutungi, to have raised it, or did it need raising?
Well, I think he did. Odinga did use tribal rhetoric, just as I think as much as Kibaki has used tribal rhetoric. My sense is that most of these leaders usually do use tribal rhetoric when it comes to election time because they believe that that does work. My sense is that most Kenyans do want the country to work and they want things to go well, but they don't really, really, they don't really, really, really identify in those tribal terms on a day-to-day basis.
Or didn't, but now, and we've seen this happen elsewhere, once the violence begins, one can be forced to identify in those terms.
Exactly. I think the violence kind of brings out all these tribal identifications that are not always there.
I want to turn for a moment, if I may, Kenda Mutungi and Jonathan Lejard in Kenya to Washington and Steve Morrison. He's director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Mr. Morrison, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Can you give us a sense of what happened here? Is there a colonial route to these tribal tensions? I mean, I read back how the British colonialists, when they moved into the agriculturally rich Rift Valley, their arrival led to the displacement of many Kenyans and the moving in of many Kikuyu. Are we dealing again here in Kenya with the long tail of a colonial legacy and the violence today?
Well, you can tie back some of the perceived grievances and tensions between Kikuyu Luo, Kikuyu Kalenjin, and others to the colonial era advantages that were accorded to the emerging Kikuyu elite in that period. And that's a dimension I think it can be overstated with respect to sort of what has happened in the independent era, and particularly for this discussion, what has happened in the last several years where you've had accelerated economic growth, which has been very concentrated, and you had the breakdown of efforts within the coalitional government post-Moi, a breakdown to change the constitutional arrangements and allow for greater space for instance, in this case, a prime ministerial position that Raila Odinga might have occupied, and greater federalism within the country. The power has been, power politically and economic advantage remains very heavily concentrated, and that has fed this perception of grievance. It has a class basis, as Kenda points out, among a disenfranchised youth bulge, a demographic phenomenon in Kenya and other parts of Africa that is very difficult to sort of imagine moving forward. But it also, this crisis, has its roots in a style of political leadership within this generation, this older and fading generation of represented by Kibaki and Odinga and others, which has been ready to step up interethnic violence, stoke it for their advantage, and not to commit to reverse this.
So we look back to the great, the big independence leader, Jomo Kenyatta, who tried to downplay tribalism, Daniel Arap Moi, who ruled for so long, established a kind of strongman rule, and now these two.
Well, I think we need to bring it back into focus as sort of what the real choices are right now. Kenya, I think, as Jonathan and Kenya both brought forward, Kenya sort of hangs in the balance right now. It's gone It's gone beyond the expectations of any of us who were watching this razor-thin margin in the lead-up to the elections, when and what was the likely aftermath to be. It's gone beyond that. I think the focus needs to be back upon what Kofi Annan may be able to deliver, and how do his internal and external backers use their influence to best advantage to try to stall out the worst options and get some kind of negotiating process back on track, because there is no plan B. There is no plan B if Kofi Annan fails.
I want to ask you what that would mean for the country and for East Africa, but first to this question of the possibility of working something out. Jonathan, I want to go to you, but let's listen first to an opposition supporter in Nairobi this week saying the elections must be clarified for the good of the country.
We want peace, but we want justice. We want CIDs in Kenya to investigate and give us the result and the truth of Mugabe.
Jonathan Lejard, in Kisumu, Kenya, do you see hope of some kind of breakthrough either on clarifying or rectifying the election's outcome or on some kind of power-sharing agreement that would lead Kibaki and Odinga to call for real calming down? Jonathan?
Just a couple of points from my perspective to clarify. I do feel that we are letting Mwai Kibaki off the hook by talking about disputed election in which the opposition complained. That, to a listener in the radio station in the States, sounds like Raila Odinga has, you know, sour grapes and doesn't know how to lose.
It's too mild.
I was there in the election commission. The doors were locked. Security personnel from the government went in there. They banned foreign election observers and local election observers. They simply crossed out votes which ordinary Kenyans had cast and wrote in new numbers. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, the international community has to start with this essential first point, which is to punish the Kibaki administration for trying to steal an election. We don't know, in the end, how much Raila Odinga would have won by, or even if Mwai Kibaki would have won by about 50,000 votes. But most serious election observers think that Raila Odinga won by about 4 or 5% of the vote. And that, by the way, is why the United States government is not releasing the results of its own exit polls, which showed Raila Odinga ahead by 8 or 9%. That would be far too explosive in this situation.
Jonathan, let us put that to our friend in Washington, Steve Morrison. Was Washington too quick to, instead of saying, this may have been stolen, this may have been rigged, and we need to go back and rectify it, the first thing I remember hearing out of Washington was, oh, Kenyans, find a power-sharing agreement. Just work it out. Should Washington have stood up for proper election results, Steve?
There was an early mistake made that first Saturday in the statement that came out of the embassy commending the results, and there was an effort made to reverse that. That didn't help the U.S. position. There has been an effort made by the Assistant Secretary's visit to weigh in with both Kibaki and Odinga to get them to the negotiating table in support of the process that now is represented by Kofi Annan. There has been hesitation to do a couple things. One is to call for a recount of the vote versus an audit of where the voting process failed. By that I mean I don't think there's much confidence that a recount is going to give you a set of conclusions that are going to be any less confusing than what we have today. A second point has been there's been a hesitation to threaten in an overt way Kibaki with and his inner circle of hardliners with sanctions and with international condemnation. I think that may be shifting. I think that as we look at this worsening crisis in which both sides are stoking their armed youth militia, paying them, arming them, and deploying them, and creating this crisis, and not committing to reversing it. There has to be substantial step-up of pressure upon Kibaki.
We'll look at how that might work in just a moment. Let's take a call from Billerica, Massachusetts. Boga, you're on the air.
Yes, please.
Hi.
Mine is not a question, actually, because I'm from Kenya and I was born in Kenya, but I spent like 10 years here in the U.S.
Yes.
The most shocking thing to me is I flew all the way to Kenya to vote this last December.
Good for you.
Yeah, because, everybody loves their country. But the thing is, I think the opposition leader, Mr. Raila Odinga, needs to calm down and admit that Kibaki won the election because, I mean, he's not the first African leader or the world leader from the opposition to have lost. I mean,
But how do you know that Kibaki won the election? We're hearing here from Jonathan Lejard in Kenya saying international observers saying this looked really bad. If it were stolen, shouldn't a Democratic challenger stand up and insist on it being done right, Boga?
Yeah, they can do that, but they have to use the legal process whereby they have to go to the courts and then they can challenge at the court, but not telling the youth and the poor people to get out of the street and demonstrate. And the people whom you are telling to get out and demonstrate in the street, these are poor people, jobless people, and homeless people. I mean, you need to tell your lawyers and your own administration, let's head to the court and seek justice.
If justice looks like a real possibility. Mboga, thank you very much for your call. Kenda Mutongi, what does your heart tell you now? That these leaders should settle for a settlement, or that the challenger should push for an audit, a recount, or a revote?
I do agree with Steve. I don't think a recount will yield any kind of conclusive results. And I don't think, some people have been calling for another election. I don't think that's necessarily a solution either, because I think that an election like that is going to come with greater violence. I do agree with Jonathan that the results of the elections were very, very tampered with, and we really don't know who won. And so I think what I think would be useful is if both Kibaki and Odinga came out and spoke to Kenyans and told them that they were out for fighting for peace rather than continuing to incite the poor people in the streets to riot.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the crisis in Kenya, East Africa's great hope melting down in tribal violence after a disputed election. We've been joined from Washington by Steve Morrison at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, from Williams College by Kenda Mutongi. She grew up in a small village near Kisumu, Kenya, where our third guest, Jonathan Lejar, joins us from today. He's the Nairobi-based East Africa correspondent for The Economist. The reporting out of Kenya since the election at the end of December has been so vivid and so heartbreaking. Here again is NPR correspondent Gwen Tompkins. She was in western Kenya on the outskirts of a troubled town, Eldoret, speaking with a woman whose family had come under attack.
Area residents were burned alive in the church Tuesday. They had come to the church for protection against their neighbors. In the aftermath of a disputed election that returned President Mwai Kibaki to office, those who voted for him have been the targets of attack. But the police say this has never happened before in Kenya. No one has ever set fire to a church.
They are our neighbors, the people who are burning, killing, beating. Yeah, they are boys we were in school with. We were in the same class, the same school. We sat for our examinations together. So they are not new people to us.
Janet Kamauya was there when it happened. Like Kibaki, she is a Kikuyu, and her family has been living in the area since 1965. And like nearly all Kikuyus nationwide, she supported Kibaki for a second term. But others in the area supported the challenger, Raila Odinga, a Luo. Many of the Kalenjin tribe, the Luhya, the Kisii, and the Pokot were so disappointed with the result of the race that they told Kamauya that they would come for revenge against the Kikuyu.
There's a sort of claim they put on their face, not to be recognized. But when our eyes met with them, they were full of shame.
When our eyes met, they were flashing. Gwen Tompkins there for NPR's Morning Edition. Jonathan Lejard is in Kisumu in Kenya. Jonathan, much more blood since that report came through. And now, as Kenda Mutongi says, there are class issues, there are tribal issues, there's blood on people's hands. What kind of appeal or settlement looks to you on the ground there as if it might influence those who are fighting in the streets, setting up those roadblocks to calm down and return to something like peace?
Well, I mean, first of all, Kenda's exactly right. When she talks about class issues, I would maybe phrase it slightly differently, that you have an elite and a small middle class Kenya which is talking to itself. And, you know, the first thing I did as a foreign correspondent was a report on the wars in former Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, one of the most striking things, differences between reporting on this trouble in Kenya as opposed to, say, Bosnia, is how much more civilized Kenyan professional classes compared with the Yugoslav professional class.
Hmm.
There is no, or almost no, media calling for killing, calling for burning, calling for ethnic cleansing. Almost all of the professional class of Kenya has been calling for peace. At the same time, as Ken was saying, the underclass of the country on both sides, that's Kikuyu basically versus the rest of Kenya, they are really disaffected. And the only political solution that I see is the Kikuyu elite dominated politics legally and illegally since independence. They have to hand over a large amount of political power, real power, to people they don't like. And everything hinges on whether they have the courage or the guts or whether they get bullied into doing it. If they don't do it, this country is going to rip itself apart.
Steve Morrison, give us the regional picture surrounding. There seems to be the fear now, the real danger of Kenya tearing apart. It's in a tough neighborhood, Somalia already in big trouble. We've all heard so much about Sudan. You don't have to go so far past Uganda to Rwanda to see that kind of breakdown. Kenya has been seen as a kind of anchor of stability in this region. If it really blows, if it should somehow break down or collapse, people are using the word now, what does it mean for the region, for Africans' interest there, for the American interest there?
Well, if there is a long-term meltdown within Kenya, it's going to have profound economic and security implications for the surrounding region. It is an engine of growth. It's a regional hub in terms of communications and transport and banking and finance, and if that is all called into question, we've already begun to see the impact in terms of supplies of essential commodities and inputs, energy and the like, into the surrounding region, and it will not help the broader security and environment. It will do damage severely to the peace efforts with respect to Sudan. It will damage the image, significantly the image of the African Union, which is not at a high point in any case. The African Union is beginning their summit today and tomorrow. And
with the chairman there, Alpha Konare, talking about the possibility of genocide in Kenya.
Well, I think it's premature to jump to the conclusion that ethnic cleansing is becoming genocide. I think you have extensive ethnic cleansing, and that is different from that raises the specter of the possibility of genocide.
I agree, and I'm glad for that. I only report that the AU chairman has today used that word, or yesterday.
Yes, it's definitely in the air. It's part of the fear that we have. In terms of U.S. interests, we have substantial U.S. interests within this region, which are going to be weakened by having the absence of an effective, well-governed, coherent partner in the form of Kenya. And that may be one of the factors that complicates the and clouds the response of the United States to this crisis. But I think it's one that also accounts for why you see the president mentioning this, you see the Secretary of State making statements, and I think also why you see presidential candidates like Senator Obama focusing. Not only is it a personal linkage to Kenya, mm-hmm. but it's an awareness on his part and within his campaign staff of the significance of what's happening in Kenya.
Kenda Mutongi, the United States delivers something like $500 million a year in aid to Kenya, much of it not to the government, but straight into AIDS and other humanitarian programs. Do you think the U.S. Should get involved here in a more direct way? Should they put pressure on Mwai Kibaki to step aside even?
I think that would help. I think that, as Jonathan said, that a lot of people who are not Kikuyus really do feel that Kikuyus, as the Kenyans say, have had their time to eat. It's their time. It's now time for the other groups to have some power, and so. I do believe that if more pressure were put on Kibaki, that some of this power sharing or yielding of power to other groups might happen. I worry a lot about also the regional kind of the regional implications of the troubles in Kenya, and I worry a lot about Uganda, which is a landlocked country and whose a lot of the economic activities go through Kenya, like the goods and so on.
Just
and
on Kenya's western border there along
exactly,
the Rift Valley.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And it also looks like some refugees are moving into Uganda as well. So it's not looking good at all.
The opposition leader Raila Odinga Eluo joking that, of course, Barack Obama's father, a Kenyan of the Luo tribe, Odinga joked bitterly that Luo might be elected president of the United States
exactly.
before it happens in Kenya.
Yeah.
James is calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. James, you're on the air.
Hi, I appreciate the perspective you're bringing.
Thank you.
A friend of mine and his wife spent 3 months in Kenya over the summer teaching at a seminary and working at a regional clinic. And when he came back, his perspective was that the Islamist activists on the ground were responsible for much of the violence. In fact, several of the students at the seminary where he taught were killed specifically because they were Christian seminary students. And I'm just wondering what your panel would have to say about the role of religion in this particular conflict, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, James. Let us look at that. Jonathan Lejard in Kisumu, Kenya. Kenya has a long border, eastern border, with Somalia. Our caller raises the question of Islamists' activity in Kenya and their potential role in the tension and conflicts there. Do you see that or not?
Well, obviously, I can't speak to the precise incident the caller is referring to, but in general, I can pour cold water on this notion that that Islamists were involved. One of the most striking things about Kenya in this meltdown is that the matrix of religion has not entered into it at all. People don't care whether you're a Muslim, a Christian, if you're Catholic, Protestant. It's not a fault line that actually works in Kenya, even on the coast where most of Kenyan Muslims live. And I've spent the last 2 years trying to track Islamist and Al Qaeda cells in relation to Somalia, and the main conclusion that one comes up with is about the moderation of Kenyan Muslims and their responsibility and their very good relationship. So it's very normal for a mullah to sit down with a Catholic priest in a town on the coast, and they take coffee together and they talk about their communities. So I don't see any Islamist element whatsoever in this trouble.
That's good to hear. Here's the voice of one man earlier this month who had been walking more than 2 hours from the shantytown of Kibera to downtown Nairobi, just to bear in mind the human cost of all this. He was searching for something to eat for his family.
Things are distorted. There are no shops. There's no food. Children have died. Women have died. People are now running away. So this is too much for the normal human being.
Let's take a call from Kimani, calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Kimani, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
I just wanted to weigh in a little bit. I just left Kenya not too long ago, about a week ago. And like everybody is saying, there's a lot of stuff going on and not good things. What I saw was not very nice. But I also I would like to also to bring forth this point that I know there has been a lot of development going on in Kenya within the last 5 years, and taking into consideration the previous regime that has been there for 24 years and the Kenyatta regime that had been there for 15 years.
Yes,
I don't think there's anything, whatever Kikuyu have done, Kikuyu are just hardworking people, and whatever it is, they are dying because of their hardworking, because they did not do anything within the last 24 years where somebody else was in the realm. So,
but there's so much history here, I'm sure you know well, Kimani. I mean, when independence came all the way back in the 1960s and Kenyatta came to power, all the land, British-owned land, went to the government, and that went mainly to elite, wealthy Kikuyu in large part. Does that legacy need to be addressed now?
Well, it could be addressed, but then this is, after 24 years of another regime, of another presidency, I think it would just be fair that, why is it 24 years later? I mean, the people who are living in Rift Valley and Kisumu, most of them didn't get everything from the previous president. Most of them is their hard work and sweat that has put them in there.
What do you think should happen now, Kimani? What can be done?
Well, I think what it is that while those two people should sit down and talk, people should also reflect and see backward and see what development has taken place and what need to be taken on forth, because really fighting and inciting other people, the poor people, to fight and get in the street while the other people, the rich people jump into their SUVs and speed off and let the poor people dying, I don't think that is fair for anybody.
Kimani, thank you very much for your call. Last thoughts here. Steve Morrison, to you. What do you hope for in this picture?
Well, we have to hope that that Kofi Annan is able to be successful. I mean, he's the last major thing standing between the current worsening violence and a dramatic escalation of it. I think we need to throw our support behind that effort at getting the leadership of the two opposing sides to commit overtly to end the violence and to bring about a cooling off period and to enter negotiations over both the short and the long term. I think we need to step up the discussions within the UN Security Council and raise the specter that the Security Council is going to take action. I think we need to step up the dialogue with the African Union, with Canary, with the Senegalese and the South Africans and the Ghanaians and others who have been most active on this issue. And I think we need to remain very active at a very high level, at the secretarial level, in keeping attention focused upon this. There's too much at stake. Kenya hangs in the balance. This violence that we've seen, this horrible violence we've seen concentrated in the Rift, could spread and migrate into the major urban environments like Nairobi, and we could see a national internal war. It's not clear to me how the Kenyan military is going to respond to an ever higher burden coming upon its shoulders. That's one of the big unanswerable.
It's almost too much to imagine. And our time grows short. Steve Morrison, director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Steve, thank you very much for being
thank
with
you,
us.
Tom.
Jonathan Lejard, with us in this hour from Kisumu. Kenya, Nairobi-based East Africa correspondent for The Economist. Thank you, Jonathan, for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Kenda Mutongi at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Thanks for being here, Kenda.
Thank you, Tom.
We go out with a song for peace that is crackling out these days over Kenyan radio and now around the world on YouTube. Wakenya Pamoja, Kenya Together, was recorded by 36 musicians days after rioting broke out last month. Gospel music producer Robert Kamanzi, he wrote the song. He says, it's a cry to Kenya to let the people get back together. You can see the music video at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.